make up 51% of the population, but our voices are missing from the national dialogue. Think about your favorite op-ed writers. How many female names come to mind? According to a new survey from the Op-Ed Project, women write just 20% of the op-eds in the nation's leading newspapers, and our voices are practically absent in the debate about issues like the economy and foreign policy. So what explains this? On today's Your Call, we're talking about who controls our public discourse. Why is the conversation still dominated by white men? What will it take to get more women and men of color to use their voices? Join us after the news.
BBC News with David Austin. The United Nations envoy to Syria, Kofi Annan, has expressed grave concern at increased fighting between Syrian troops and rebels. He was speaking after government forces stepped up attacks on rebel strongholds. In the city of Homs, the Syrian army appeared to be using a surveillance drone to pick out buildings as part of an intense mortar attack. Mr. Annan's spokesman, Ahmad Fawzi, said more had to be done to safeguard civilians.
Mr. Annan is particularly worried about the recent shelling in Homs, as well as reports of the use of mortar, helicopters and tanks in the town of Al-Haffa in Latakia. There are indications that a large number of civilians are trapped in these towns. Mr. Annan demands that parties take all steps to ensure that civilians are not harmed. And he also further demands the entry of the UN military observers into the town of Al-Haffa immediately.
The United States has withdrawn its negotiators from Pakistan after talks failed over reopening NATO supply routes from the Pakistani port of Karachi to Afghanistan. Pakistan blocked the supply routes last November after US forces mistakenly killed 24 Pakistani soldiers at a border post. Kim Gatas reports from Washington.
The talks started 7 weeks ago and have been marred by other issues like American drone attacks, Pakistani pride, and a general history of mistrust between the two countries. Pakistan has also been asking for $5,000 for each of the 5,000 trucks that made the journey on average before the closing. But traffic is expected to increase when troops start departing Afghanistan. In the meantime, NATO has reached a deal to bypass Pakistan and transport military equipment out through Central Asian countries like Uzbekistan.
Border guards in Bangladesh have turned back hundreds of people fleeing deadly violence between Muslims and Buddhists in neighbouring Burma. Officials say they've intercepted 6 boats carrying people from the Muslim Rohingya ethnic group. A state of emergency has been declared in Rakhine State in Burma, where at least 17 people have been killed and hundreds of homes burned down. The UNHCR representative in Bangladesh, Craig Saunders, said they'd appealed to the Bangladeshi government to allow refugees into the country.
We do understand that on both sides of the border, they are trying to control the situation and control the security, and that's true on both sides of the border. We've made appeals to the government of Bangladesh that, as much as possible, leave the borders open, allow people, particularly those who are injured, to try to get across if they are fleeing the violence.
Early optimism about a deal to bail out Spain's banks have faded. Germany and the European Commission have stressed the terms of the agreement will be subject to strict monitoring. In Madrid, interest rates on government debt have risen again, and the stock exchange lost most of its initial gains. This is the BBC. A number of opposition activists in Russia have been called in for questioning by police on the eve of an anti-government rally in Moscow on Tuesday. Earlier, their homes were searched. Computers and papers were confiscated. Police said the raids were part of an investigation into violence during a street protest against President Vladimir Putin last month. Steve Rosenberg has more.
Across Moscow today, police armed with semi-automatic rifles came to the homes of prominent anti-government activists and launched searches. Among those whose flat was searched was TV presenter Ksenia Sobchak. Ms. Sobchak told the BBC 10 men in masks had burst into her apartment with guns. They'd seized a large sum of money and her passport.
I never thought in the beginning of the 90s that once again we will be back in such a strong authoritarian regime, which is actually becoming totalitarian.
Opposition figures accused the Kremlin of clamping down on future dissent.
The president of Niger says West African nations will seek a United Nations mandate for military intervention in Mali, which he said had become an international security threat. Mahamudu Issoufou said Afghan and Pakistani Islamist groups were training recruits in northern Mali, which has been controlled by rebels since a military coup in March. Mr. Issoufou was speaking in France after talks with President Hollande. Mr. Hollande said France would be ready to support military action in Mali, but that ECOWAS nations should take the lead. The Nobel Foundation says it's cutting the amount of money it awards to Nobel Prize winners because of the economic crisis. The foundation says poor economic conditions in recent years have meant the returns it receives on its capital have not kept pace with its costs. Future Nobel Prize awards will be cut by 20% to just over $1 million. And those are the latest stories from BBC News.
Welcome back. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. If you read the newspaper over the weekend, chances are you checked out the op-ed pages. They're still one of the most widely read sections of the newspaper and the most emailed. If you read the op-ed pages, you probably have favorite writers. Now, how many of those writers are women? Unfortunately, we're hard to find. We make up over half of the population, but according to a new byline study by the Op-Ed Project, we write only 20% of the opinion pieces in the nation's leading newspapers. We're talking about the New York Times, the Washington Post, the LA Times, and the Wall Street Journal. And this study was conducted between September 15th and December 7th. And women are missing from most debates on very important issues like the economy and U.S. foreign policy. According to the Op-Ed Project, quote, "The voices we hear come from a tiny fraction of society, mostly Western, white, privileged, and overwhelmingly male. Men are between 80 to 90% of contributors on key opinion forums, 84% of TV pundits on Sunday morning talk shows, 87% of Wikipedia contributors, and 83% of Congress. In short, public debate all but excludes half the population. So where are women and men of color? Why aren't we taking part in public discourse? What happens to the conversation when it's dominated by white men? How does this impact our society? And most importantly, what can we do about it? The Op-Ed Project's mission is to increase the range of voices and quality of ideas we hear in the world. A starting goal is to increase the number of women thought leaders in key commentary forums to a tipping point. And they do this in two ways. They've designed a mentor editor program for women to write and submit op-eds, and they also host Write to Change the World seminars across the country. There's a seminar happening this Saturday in San Francisco, and you can find more information about it at yourcallradio.org. Joining us to talk about the survey and the work they're doing is Katie Orenstein. She's founder and director of the Op-Ed Project. Katie has contributed to the op-ed pages of the New York Times, Washington Post, and Miami Herald. She's author of Little Red Riding Hood Uncloaked, Sex, Morality, and the Evolution of a Fairy Tale, which explores stories told about women over 500 years across multiple continents and how they shape our lives today. And Katie joins us from New York. Hi, Katie. Welcome to the show.
Hi, great to be here.
It's great to have you. We're also joined by Taryn Yeager. Taryn compiled the data for the latest Op-Ed Project survey. She tracked over 7,000 bylines for the report and did the statistical analysis. And Taryn is Director of Operations for the Op-Ed Project. Hi, Taryn. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. So, Taryn, let me start with you. Since you did all of this work and looked at 7,000 bylines, which is incredible, what really struck you about the data that you compiled?
I think what struck me the most was the changes in my perception of it was the standards. Where I became happy with seeing 35% of women published in one day, and I said, "Oh, that's terrific." I was really struck by that, and I said, "My expectations are so low." And so, you know, as my personal experience going through it, that was most striking. But as far as the statistics go, what I think stood out the most was that just 11% of women wrote about, or 11% of articles on economics were written by women. And, so that one, I think, was the most dire statistic.
And Erica Fry, who's done part-time work for the Op-Ed Project, wrote a great piece in the Columbia Journalism Review called It's 2012 Already, Why is Opinion Writing Still Mostly Male? And I love her lead. It says, man, 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 man. And this was a quote by Sue Horton, the op-ed and Sunday opinion editor at the LA Times. And she was talking to Erica, basically just flipping through her pile of op-eds, calling out the gender of every author. And out of 32, she got six women. And we invited Sue, but she's in a meeting, so she couldn't join us today. And Katie, when I tell people about the low percentage, they're kind of shocked. And then when they try to name women op-ed writers, they can't. And so when you share this information with people, are they surprised at these low numbers?
Yes, I think people are surprised, even though this has been widely reported. In fact, there was a huge amount of press even this month about it, and it's not the first time. But I think people are surprised because I think that there are highly successful women who become examples, and we forget that they are exceptional, that they're not the norm. And when we have someone, you know, we have a Gail Collins or Maureen Dowd or Katie Couric, or in politics with Hillary Clinton, or, you know, we have these prominent, successful women leaders. So it's easy to have a misconception that these women are actually exceptions and that statistically we are not well represented at the highest levels of leadership and thought leadership.
And what really struck you about the report?
Two really important things. I think the first, and this is crucial, our report is not really about op-eds, and nor is our work. The report is titled, Who Narrates the World? And so what we're really looking at is who are the individuals and what are the ideas that are shaping society today? And so these forums, key commentary forums, are actually the most obvious place that you can look for that, where public opinion, public policy, and public knowledge is being shaped. But I think it's really important for all of us to keep in mind that what we're really talking about is who narrates the world, because these people drive talent and they drive resources, and it determines what ideas get funded and what policies get funded, and it has enormous consequences for us. So many of your listeners might be thinking, gee, I don't know, should I write an op-ed? Does that really matter very much? And the answer is, well, write an op-ed or not, maybe it's not an op-ed, but it does matter if you have a voice, and it really matters collectively if only one small group of people have a voice, because they end up making decisions for the rest of us by default.
Taryn, why don't you talk a little bit about that, who narrates the world? When you were looking at these bylines, what sorts of articles are women writing about, or what issues are women writing about?
Well, the only articles that women wrote a higher proportion of than men did were on women-focused subject matter, on family and sex, food and fashion. And that applied to both new media and traditional media. And the rest of it was far behind. The worst was economics and international affairs, which was at 13% in traditional media.
So when we're talking about who's narrating the world, our voices, women's voices, are almost just completely missing from the dialogue on the economy and U.S. foreign policy.
Right.
Well, Rose, if I could just leap in,
sure.
What you said is correct, but one of the most fascinating things about Taryn's data is that, you know, there is this kind of important warning information in the data. Yes, we're dramatically underrepresented, and where we are represented, we're overwhelmingly and disproportionately writing about sort of siloed, quote-unquote, feminine topic matter. Not that there's anything wrong with that topic matter, it just means that on all the other topics, we're even more underrepresented. But there's also really, really exciting positive news that I think most of the media ignore because it's not as interesting a story, but it's really exciting to us because we work in this field, and the news is this. In the last 5 years or so, there's been a 6% improvement in terms of women's representation overall as a proportion of opinion writing in key commentary and thought leadership forums in traditional media. And also, there's been a huge shift as we move online. So if we look at new media, nearly, I think Taryn can speak to the specific data points, but nearly a third or maybe even over a third of commentary in key forums that we monitored was by women. And those numbers, that's a really huge positive shift. And I think we need to keep both of those things, both the positive news as well as the sort of warning about, you know, that this is an, that we need to keep them both in mind, that there's an opportunity here, and that what we want people to take away from this is not that the news is all bad, but rather that there's a fantastic opportunity, and we can all, not just women, but all of us, we can use this opportunity that we have to have a bigger voice, particularly as we move online and more people have access to speak to wider audiences, or we can choose to balkanize ourselves and to write about topics that only people who look and talk like us will read.
Right.
And it's a choice we have right now.
Well, right. And Taryn, why don't you talk about that? What was different about online media when you looked at the bylines and the issues women are writing about versus, say, the New York Times and the Washington Post?
Sure. And if I could just quickly, I wanted to say that it's actually a 6 percentage point increase in the traditional media. The percentage increases are 29% in the New York Times, 88% in the Washington Post, and 20% in the LA Times.
Okay.
So those are pretty big. But as far as the new media goes, what we see happening there is that women are writing a lot more often about what we call the pink topics, the food, fashion, family, furniture, and women's and gender issues. One third of the writing in new media we found was about these topics. And even though a high proportion of their writing was on these pink topics, they still contributed to the general interest topics more often than women did in traditional media.
And that is Taryn Yeager. She is Director of Operations for the Op-Ed Project. We're also joined by Katie Orenstein, Founder and Director of the Op-Ed Project. And they're out with a new survey called Who Narrates the World? And it found that women write about 20% of opinion pieces in the nation's leading newspapers, and our voices are mostly missing from hard news topics like the economy and U.S. foreign policy. And I'd like to introduce our next guest now. John Diaz is editorial page editor with the San Francisco Chronicle, and John is joining us from the Chronicle offices. Hi, John. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. It's my pleasure.
It's great to have you. So you've been listening in on this conversation. What has your experience been like at the Chronicle? Do you keep track of how many women write op-eds?
Well, we have from time to time done surveys and or audits, if you will, to see, you know, how our representation is going, both in terms of our op-ed page as well as in letters to the editor. It's also an issue, interestingly, if you look what comes in just over the transom. I think there's a really important discussion, and I think that the criticisms and concerns that are being raised are very legitimate. They're things that we talk about here, and how we're going to approach it, how we're going to diversify the opinions on our page, and I'm very intrigued. I missed the very first part. I don't know if the Chronicle's numbers were in there. I suspect we are below 50%, and I think there are reasons for that, and they're not necessarily, you know, good explanations. But I think, you know, a couple things. Let me just make a couple points. One. As you know, Rose, I wasn't aware that this show was going to come, so I certainly was not pandering or trying to make ourselves look good by, if you look at our ed page today, our editorial page, the dominant piece on there is on economics and foreign affairs, and it's by Kai Milner, one of our editorial writers who had spent a year on a fellowship in Europe. So I think she has some very fresh perspectives. I think she makes the author's point here in terms of the need to get new voices and new perspectives in. I think there's a couple reasons it happens. I mean, one is if you look at the composition of the people who are in positions of influence, you know, you look at the legislators, you look at the Department of Economics, who the professors are, the folks who are, if you will, the usual suspects for experts, it tends to be male-dominated. So I think it takes an extra effort to overcome that. At the Chronicle, our op-eds are determined by my deputy editorial page editor, Lois Kazakoff, and she is very, very aware and concerned about these kinds of issues. In fact, she might even disagree in terms of whether there's pink topics or male topics, because her feeling is that a lot of women's perspectives is missing from public policy, so you can't necessarily divide them that way.
Well, John, we're actually looking at the Chronicle right now, and out of four opinion pieces, one is written by a woman.
Mm-hmm. In today's
Chron.
Right.
Yeah.
Rose, can I answer John for
yes, please.
Weigh in here quickly? First of all, I just want to say I'm a huge fan of the Chronicle, and I think Lois Kazakoff has done a great job not only opening up the page, but particularly inviting more women. And I know that she's written editorials specifically inviting more women to submit.
Yeah.
So, and the last data I had, the Chronicle was doing better in this department than the national average. So, kudos to you. We just want to be really clear. We consider our role not to criticize you per se, the editor, not you personally, but editors of media, but rather to be helpful by increasing the range of good voices from diverse sources all around that you might actually hear from coming through the transom. So we're not here. You know, we consider our role to be collaborative, not combative at all, and we think you're doing a good job. That said, I do want to just issue one comment. Just, I don't want this to go unedited. The idea that experts and sort of certain fields tend to be male-dominated, it's true, but it doesn't explain everything. For example, if you look at the field of economics, which, as Taryn noted, that was one of the most sort of stark, depressing pieces of data we had of all the thousands of op-eds that were written on the economy, only 11% were written by women. And yet, if you looked at who PhDs go to, well over a third of PhDs are going to women now. And that's been more or less the same, give or take a few percentage points, for over 10 years. So by now, you would think that, we have a ton of, women experts on the economy, credentialed, high-level, tenured women experts on the economy, and we would expect that we would see maybe 35% or somewhere around there of opinions coming from on the economy coming from women, and in fact we see only 11%. So it really makes us wonder what is the source of that, and maybe even the way we think of experts, both when we solicit experts and also the way we think of our own expertise, mm-hmm. as men and women, maybe it's more complex.
Well, and I'd love to get listeners in on this. John Diaz will be with us for the next 7 or so minutes. John is editorial page editor with The Chronicle. We're also joined by Katie Ornstein, founder and director of the Op-Ed Project, and Taryn Yeager, director of operations for the Op-Ed Project. And we'd love to hear from you. What really strikes you when you read op-ed pages? And do you have favorite female writers? What do we really lose when men dominate most of the debates we're hearing today? What can we do to add more voices to the debate? And if you've submitted an op-ed or were called on for your area of expertise, what was your experience like? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also leave a comment at yourcallradio.org or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. So John, because you're going to leave us in about 5 or so minutes, talk about what your experience is like when you get submissions. I think you heard me read the lead of Erica Frey's article in the Columbia Journalism Review. Sue Horton was on the phone with her, flipping through the op-eds, and she said, man, 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 man. What's it like at the Chronicle?
Well, I think if you look at what comes in over the transom, that it is much more male-dominated than what you see actually in the paper. Lois Kazakoff, who's our deputy editor who does the screening of op-eds, actually has a theory that one of the, is for cultural reasons, that in this society, like, men tend to be more assertive, more in terms of assuming that their comment is worthy of being published, as opposed to a woman who may be equally conversant and erudite on a subject may want to be contacted first instead of just sort of a cultural issue. So we, even though over the transom we are getting clearly a male-dominated submission, I don't think that that is a good enough excuse for us, that we do have to go out and cultivate experts. As you were saying during the discussion, there are a lot of women out there who are very qualified to talk on a number of subjects. They may not be sort of the usual suspects that they get published in op-eds, and it's our job, and I think Lois has done a very good job here at the Chronicle in going out and finding new voices for our pages.
And Katie, going back to what you mentioned about expertise and sort of women thinking of themselves as experts and having something to offer, talk a little bit about what you experience in the Right to Change the World seminars when you broach this topic with women. What really stands out for you? You've taught, what, about 1,000 classes by now?
Not me personally, but well over that, I think. Us and our team, we have a team of essentially professional writers, journalists, columnists, and editors who all around the country give classes, programs that are, many of which are open to the public, including one on June 16 in San Francisco, which we'd love to have anyone who's in the Bay Area come and join us for. But one of the things, I think when we started these programs, the basic idea was, you know, apropos of what John was saying, could we increase the submissions from smart, you know, credentialed, you know, women with wonderful ideas? Could we just do that? And by the way, also all other kinds of diverse voices, and maybe we could just share basic skills. But what happened really quickly is we became aware that there was something more going on, which is a lot of the people we encountered immediately discredited themselves and immediately started to sort of deny their own expertise. And so I call it a culture of self-abnegation, where we begin to doubt our own basic competencies, and a lot of it shows up as virtues. So we might say, I don't want to brag, or I don't want to speak beyond the responsibilities of, beyond my real, actual, concrete knowledge, or I don't want it to be about myself. It should be about somebody else. And so all of those are wonderful virtues, but it's almost like we're seeing an abuse of those virtues, where we see selflessness and modesty to the point of self-abnegation, where we're not willing to take a stand for what we know and weigh in on things that might actually help other people and might be crucial for other people to know. So it's almost like we're so busy worrying about, you know, do I know enough, you know, or am I being modest enough, that we're worrying too much in a way about ourselves and not enough about, well, how would this knowledge and experience that we have, how could it impact the world and how could it help other people?
You know, when I first came in contact with the Op-Ed Project, you came to a class I attended and you asked a really great question. And I'd love to actually ask listeners, if you could write an op-ed for the New York Times tomorrow, what would it be about and why haven't you written it? And what struck me were the answers. I don't know enough. I'm not an expert. Why would anyone listen to me? I haven't done enough research.
Yeah, I'm too young. I'm too old.
Right.
People will laugh at me. I don't have the right degree. I'm not a real doctor.
Right.
You name it.
Yeah. So we'll talk about that more after the break. But before we let you go, John, it's great that you're open to, you know, that there's a problem here and open to working with the Op-Ed Project on this. What else needs to happen to change these numbers so we get to the tipping point?
Well, I think two things have to happen. One is, I think newspapers do need to be more assertive in going out and finding these new voices. And I also think we need to get the word out that our pages are welcome to different voices. And one of the things in my role, when I'm looking at the proofs of our pages to go out every day, and I'll look at the letters to the editor, sometimes there may just be one letter from a woman, or there may be, in some cases, zero. And the first thing I'm going to do as an editor is ask our letters editor, aren't we getting any letters from women? And a lot of times we are. And it's a matter of just as when we look at our page and we don't want all the letters to be from San Francisco and Berkeley.
Right.
We also want to get different voices and different perspectives. So, it's not an easy thing to do because I thought as this discussion has made clear, there are cultural barriers as well, but I think the main thing that the message that I would want to get out from this program is that, one, we do acknowledge that there's a disparity and that that is not good for, in terms of our duty of showing the full realm of issues in the world, and that we do welcome more letters and more op-ed pieces from women, and that is something we're concerned about.
All right. Well, we'll be pitching you, John.
Thank you. Perfectly fine. That's
okay.
Why we're here.
Great. Thanks for joining us. That's John Diaz, editorial page editor with the San Francisco Chronicle. And today we are talking about op-eds, and we'll be back after a short break.
Hello, this is Chuck Feeney of Your Legal Rights. If you use a computer at work and would like to know what privacy rights you as an employee may have in using the computer, or if you're an employer and want to know what your rights are to access your employee's computer, please join me this Wednesday evening at 7. My guests will be employment law attorneys Brian Schwartz and Jonathan Wong. That's this Wednesday evening at 7 on Your Legal Rights here on 91.7 KLW San Francisco.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. You can find more information about our show at yourcallradio.org. You can also listen to past shows there and sign up for our newsletter to find out what's coming up. Tomorrow, we'll have a conversation with Raj Patel, author of Stuffed and Starved, The Hidden Battle for the World Food System. 1 in 7 people on Earth are hungry, and 1 billion people are overweight. He says global hunger and obesity are symptoms of the same problem. So how did we get here, and what are solutions? On Wednesday, we'll have a conversation with Lindsay Hilsum, author of Sandstorm, Libya in the Time of Revolution. And then Thursday, we'll be speaking with Eve Ensler about her new play at the Berkeley Rep, Emotional Creature. Today, we are talking about who narrates the world. When you think about the voices you hear in the national dialogue, whether it's on the radio or on television or the voices you hear in the newspaper, what really stands out for you? And when you hear about a survey coming out of the Op-Ed Project that just 20% of women write the on the editorial pages of the major newspapers like the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times, how does that really affect our national dialogue? We'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. What does it mean when maybe white men dominate the dialogue, and what can we do to change this? If you've ever written or tried to write an op-ed or possibly take part in a debate, what happened? What was the experience like? And if you have some favorite female writers, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. And what about the larger question of women and thinking of ourselves as experts and really putting our ideas out there? I have to say, when we do shows about the economy or U.S. foreign policy, our phone calls are definitely male-dominated. So it's interesting also to watch our guest selection, who comes up, who calls. So we'd love to hear from you on how this whole conversation really affects the larger public debate. You can leave a comment, yourcallradio.org. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we're joined by Katie Orenstein, founder and director of the Op-Ed Project. Their mission is to increase the range of voices and quality of ideas we hear in the world. They're hosting a Right to Change the World seminar this Saturday in San Francisco. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. Taryn Yeager is director of operations for the project. She tracked over 7,000 bylines for the report. And I should mention, for full disclosure, that I recently joined the Op-Ed Project as a mentor, and I'm also leading seminars, and it's been an incredible experience. We've got a couple of listeners on the line, so let's hear from KDF in Oakland. Hi, KDF. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you. I'm so glad you're having this show. And I think it's very important to remember that so many women in their own homes are ignored or cut off. So, for example, if we had a large group of families where the men honored and listened to the women's voices in their own homes, and little boys didn't feel that by the time they're age 10, their opinion is more important than their mother's, then I think we would have a whole generation of young women who do value their own voices and who do feel that their expertise is up to par. And so when I hear the guests talking about how women put themselves down, there's a really good reason for that. I remember when I was a younger person, I was having a political conversation with guys who were all about a head taller than me. And when I made a particularly salient point, one of them looked over my head at the other two guys and said, "She doesn't know what she's talking about," which really meant he couldn't follow my logic, and so he didn't know what I was talking about.
Hmm. Well, thank you for the comment. Taryn, would you like to respond?
Well, I think that's a great comment, Kate. And the roots of this are very personal. All of us have had experiences where we're not taught that we are experts. And, of course, the Op-Ed Project doesn't just focus on women. We focus on all underrepresented voices in society. So we see this with people of different races, people of different income levels. Mm. And, yes, I completely agree with you. It starts from the youngest age, when we're taught who we are, what our identities are, what our worth is, our place in society.
And Katie, do you have anything to add?
Well, I think Taryn just said it beautifully. I do want to acknowledge that the listeners' comments are, you know, we are not in any way suggesting, it's not intended as criticism, it's merely an observation. The kinds of things that we hear overwhelmingly from women and from people of color. And I think the thing to remember is that we live in a cultural context that makes it very hard if you are a minority voice. And by minority voice, I include women, because although we're a majority of the population, we are a minority of voice. And we live in a culture that makes it very hard if you're a minority voice to feel certain of yourself or to feel secure or even confident. There's a good amount of research that, you know, minority voices tend to doubt our own basic competencies. We face a lot of resistance. We face a lot more risk. It's much riskier to speak up. The kind of comment like Kate, I think your name was, the listener, said is, you know, that's a typical thing to, not that in any way it should be, but it's a typical comment that we hear from people coming through the project, that experience of being in some way discounted or misunderstood, but misunderstood and cast in a way that's not beyond mere misunderstanding. And, I think we're trying very hard to separate the idea that, you know, what we're saying might in some way be our problem from the larger truth, which is that actually it's a cultural problem, a larger cultural problem, but we're all part of this culture.
Mm. Well, thank you for the comment, KDF. We have a comment on Facebook from Diana who says, "Women need to give themselves permission to articulate their views on serious matters in public forums, including social media. Women also need to consider that their views are important. Women are as valuable as the other half of the human race, but often we don't act like it." Oh, well, thank you for the comment, Diana. And let's go to our next caller, Heidi in Big Sur. Heidi, welcome to the show.
Hi. Well, I couldn't agree with all of that more. I've had the experience of being in, say, a large group of people with men and women, and I've been participating and also been somewhat of a fly on the wall. And I've noticed that if a woman is interrupted, she immediately stops talking. Mm-hmm. And I've found for myself the way that I can continue my conversation is to say, "Hold on a second, let me finish that. Let me finish that thought." And if I don't say that, I get cut off. So it is really a cultural thing, you know, and we do have to overcome it. And we don't know we're doing it.
So how do you deal with that?
Well, what I just said is, "Oh, wait, I want to finish that thought."
Hmm.
You know, and that seems to work, or some version of that. But I notice, and maybe it's an age thing also, I don't know, I'm in my 60s. I notice that other women don't even realize that they very politely just folded their hands and stopped talking.
Hmm. Well, that's interesting. Katie, in the Right to Change the World seminars, do you see many differences between different generations?
Yeah, I do. I think we see a huge difference between, I would say, categories of people that are well represented already in the media or as thought leaders or leadership versus people who are not. So I want to say that we don't think it's actually a gender thing. We think it's an entitlement thing. Mm-hmm. For example, we see men of color expressing the same kinds of issues, even using the very same language as women. And we see older women and young women sometimes saying the very same thing. Because, you know, sometimes people feel that being young is their liability, and sometimes people feel that being older is their liability. I guess the bottom line is, if we feel like we're in a vulnerable group or a group that's not highly credentialed or recognized in our mainstream culture, it perhaps has implications on how we see ourselves and express ourselves. So it's sort of this, you know, there's a feedback loop happening.
Sorry. Go ahead, Taryn.
If I could jump in there, we looked at three types of media in our survey. We did new media, traditional media, and we also did college media. And we saw numbers that were significantly higher in college, which bodes well for the future. Mm. At Columbia, for instance, they were almost at parity. And we also looked at Yale, Princeton, and Harvard, and they were all above 30%.
All right. Well, and thank you for calling in, Heidi. And what were they what are they writing about, Taryn?
Well, actually, we didn't do subject for the university media.
So, Katie, what are your thoughts on those numbers? That seems to bode well for maybe what's in store for the next survey.
I think it does bode well. I think that the numbers are shifting. I want to say that as many times as possible, because I think it's so easy to hone in on the problem and not on the solution. But even though we've got this data, which spells out the problem, it also spells out the solution and the fact that we're moving towards it. We've had really strong shifts, increases in the numbers of women who are weighing in key commentary forums, which I should remind everyone that those forums predict leadership and thought leadership in all fields. These are not forums for journalism. These are experts in all fields, academia, business, politics. And if we're putting ideas out there in these forums, it's a chance for them to grow and spread and gain traction. And this is essentially how individuals also rise in influence. So we're seeing an increase in the numbers overall, a significant increase. And we also see a really high percentage of participation in college outlets, which is suggestive to us, suggestive, not conclusive, that there is a really strong possibility that all of this will be different in, 5 years, 10 years. I do want to just take this moment to say that I see this particular part of this problem as an imminently solvable problem, even inevitably solvable problem. I think we forget that a lot of problems do get solved. We tend to think, the more things change, the more they stay the same forever and ever. But that's not always the case. And this is an example where we're already moving towards the solution that we're envisioning. So, yeah, I think we see it as really promising.
And that is Katie Ornstein, founder and director of the Op-Ed Project. Their mission is to increase the range of voices and quality of ideas we hear in the world. We're also joined by Taryn Yeager, director of operations for the Op-Ed Project, and they're hosting a Right to Change the World seminar this Saturday in San Francisco. You can find more information about it, yourcallradio.org. And if you'd like to join us, we'd love to hear from you. What really strikes you as the differences between the writers you see on the op-ed pages? What are we missing when women write just 20% of op-eds? And actually, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting conducted a separate study and found that the numbers for women of color are much worse. We roughly make up about 18% of the population, but women of color account for just 2% of columns in the Washington Post, 5 columns, 1% in the Wall Street Journal, 2 columns, and just 1 column, I was surprised by that one, at the New York Times. And that's in the 2-month period of September and October 2011. So what do we miss when our voices aren't in these pages and in the national dialogue? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. are the viewpoints significantly different from our male counterparts? You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org. And if you have a personal story to share about this topic, we'd love to hear from you. And speaking of that, we've got an experience from Roberta in Richmond. Hi, Roberta. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I'm delighted about what you're doing. Let me just tell you one thing. I was with a civil liberties group for a number of years, and we wanted people of color, people of different economic levels to be part of decision-making, be part of local boards. And we put out all this different information of support, et cetera. When it finally worked, to the degree it worked, it was really people from that community, communities, going out and suggesting it. Because, you know, when you come in, let's say you're going to a newspaper and there's some kind of forum and you're speaking, if you're the only one, this is a scary thing. And it's a scary thing if you're doing an economics forum and this is the only woman there. I mean, so there really is some outreach that makes a difference from the sources. I know we can't count on that, but I'm just saying it seemed to have made a difference.
Right. I laugh because you took me back to the mid-90s when I was a technology reporter and often the only woman in the room.
Yeah.
So I know exactly what that feels like. And, you know, even back then, my boss at the time said, look, you're in radio. It's very male-dominated. You're going to have to work twice as hard. Keep your voice low. Exude confidence. He said it's going to be a tough road, but you know, this is just the way it is, basically. That's kind of what he told me. Really good advice, but you make a good point, Roberta. And Roberta, do you want to add anything just about, you know, what is really missing when our voices aren't out there?
Yeah, a certain connection to real life.
Mm.
And it also depends on who the men are.
Right.
If the men have a connection to real life, which often they don't. You know what I mean by real life?
I do.
Okay. That's all I have to say that's valuable.
All right. Well, thank you so much. And we have a call. Let's go to Harry. He'd like to talk about whether or not viewpoints are significantly different. Hi, Harry. Welcome to the show.
I just wanted to point out that the current stock of op-ed writers, such as they are, that are female, don't represent a different viewpoint. Basically, the op-eds in the Wall Street Journal, say, or the San Francisco Chronicle seem to be attended to buttress the opinions of the people who own the paper and the very wealthy. And often the news coverage, unfortunately, also reflects that in terms of what they choose to cover. But for example, Mary Anastasia O'Grady, who covers Latin America and writes op-eds in the Wall Street Journal, she's very right-wing. Lois Kozakoff is very conservative. And there's one other woman who must be a Republican. I forget her name on the Chronicle. I never read her. So I think I don't think it's as important the gender. What's important is that they actually represent another point of view. And it seems like, except for the Bay Guardian, which has now been bought by the Examiner, so that may change, they is the only paper that really offers any real alternative points of view. Other people can write blogs or whatever, but they're not going to get in that major printed media because there's a wall there, and the wall is what the corporate interests of the owners are, and they're not going to allow a real dissent. And the letters to the editor are only limited to 150 or 200 words, and that's not enough to counter all the lies, the deceptions, the ridiculous nonsense that's pirated off of these op-eds.
Well, thank you, Harry. Actually, Fair took a look at that and found that the Wall Street Journal op-eds really don't differ from each other based on gender. What are your thoughts on this, Katie? If we look at the women who are getting on the editorial pages, I mean, obviously it's so huge, but if you look at something like the Wall Street Journal, are the views significantly different from their male counterparts?
A couple of things. The first thing I want to do is acknowledge that the concern that Harry raises is one that we have as well. We're not simply interested in gender or, for that matter, race or ethnicity or whatever. We're interested in diversity of ideas. We think that the echo chamber doesn't benefit anyone, not us, not anyone. And so we'd like to see the best range of original thinking. We'd like to see the best ideas, regardless of where or whom they come from, have a chance to be heard and shape society in the world. That's the media, and that's the world that I want to live in. So one of the things that we do to that end is we reach out beyond. It's not our project. It's a diversity of ideas project. So first of all, that includes ideas we disagree with. We welcome people of all points of view. It also includes we reach out to make sure that we get a wide range of people politically and also class. For example, you know, we do everything from, you know, Ivy League universities to working with a prison reentry program. So we do. So I am aware and I am concerned with what Harry raises. And I think also it's important to say that there's a big shift with the media right now. And I think that the idea that corporate interests of, you know, of the owners are always reflected in media is no longer the same as it was even 5-10 years ago, certainly not 15 years ago. You know, we now live in a media landscape where anyone with an internet connection can potentially have a public voice. And there are large de facto forums, de facto commons like the Huffington Post, where many, many, many people can have a voice. It doesn't mean it will be a good voice. It doesn't mean everyone will read it. But it means that we have an unprecedented opportunity to have a wider variety of voices from all kinds of voices from across the spectrum be heard. Now, the fact that we have that opportunity, it's a question of whether or not we'll use it. But we do have an unprecedented opportunity. So those are, I think those are the most important things I want to say. But maybe it's also worth just to remind us that it does, you know, just to get back to the gender angle, to remind us why it does matter. You know, it's not just, oh, we'd like to have some feminine perspectives. It's that we represent the issues that we see in our lives. Mm-hmm. And if we're not out there narrating the world and telling the story, then the things that affect us, and sometimes life or death things, won't be represented. And a great example of this is not even in the world of op-ed or media. It's a classic example, but it's heart disease. Until relatively recently, we thought that women were hormonally protected from heart disease and that heart disease was really only a killer of men. Now we know that heart disease is the number one killer of women in America, and it's extraordinary. You know, how could we have missed that for so many years? And the reason is that the research and the protocols were done by men on men, and that the symptoms of heart disease are very different in women.
Hmm. Interesting. So then how did it play out in the end?
Well, now we know. I mean, now we know that it's the number one killer.
Right.
But it, you know, I mean, just to take that one step farther, if you look at where funding for, you know, health and women, it goes disproportionately to breast cancer, when in fact the deadlier killer is heart disease. But breast cancer actually has done a really good job of getting that, you know, the information, you know, the movement around the cure for breast cancer has been extremely effective in getting information out.
And also, just to talk a little bit about the power of an op-ed, I mean, the overall goal is to increase the range of voices we hear from, and you use the op-ed as a tool. And I don't think many people understand how powerful it is and what it can lead to. So can you talk a little bit about that and give us some examples of maybe a woman you worked with who didn't, you know, was hesitant to call herself an expert and then wrote an op-ed and then the ball just kept rolling?
I think I could give a million examples. Truly, it's like it is a chance to change your life while changing the world. But the chance is not write an op-ed. The chance is be able to put your ideas out there in a concrete form so that they can start having that impact on the world. So the question that we're really engaging is, what is it you stand for and are willing to take a stand for? That's a powerful proposition. You know, and the proposition is a proposition around mattering, that we matter, that our knowledge and experience matters, and the collective impact we can have when we start putting it out there in the world. You know, there's so many examples. Some of the people who started out as alumni of our program are now actually teaching for us because they have significant media experience. In fact, our very first intern who was on, you know, Rose, she was on the call with us this morning. She's about to start teaching with us. She published a piece when we first started. So this was 4 years ago, I think, in the Christian Science Monitor, and went on to publish many more pieces. And now she's had, you know, multiple appearances on the Melissa Harris Perry Show and does media, and she's a prominent blogger. And so that's pretty life altering. I think a lot of this stems from a life altering experience for me. When I was in college, I got a fellowship to go study in Haiti. And while I was there, a coup broke out. And I began writing op-eds, which were then picked up on the Knight Ridder Newswire. And in a short amount of time, I began speaking on radio and television and at universities. And then I was invited to the White House with Jonathan Demme to speak to Clinton's Latin American Affairs advisors. And, you know, I was very young, and I remember thinking, looking around that room, how did I get in this room? How do I have a chance, you know, to have this kind of impact, you know? And it really was. It was like sort of like a light bulb.
Hmm. Well, and it seems like it's all connected when you look at these statistics. You know, 84% of pundits on Sunday shows are men. 87% of Wikipedia contributors are men. This year at the Cannes Film Festival, there were no women directors. For the National Magazine Association, Editors Association, they gave out their 25 awards last year. Not one award was given to a woman. When NPR did their last survey of the number of guests on their shows, I think it was about 2 or 3 years ago, just 20% of the guests are women. Now, there are a lot of women radio hosts, but when you look at the guests, it's very skewed. So these numbers seem to be very similar, and it seems like they shift together. So can you kind of pull back and give us the big picture? Because when you look at film, politics, you name it, it's still around 20% women.
Yeah, these are not coincidental statistics, nor is it a nice, neat, linear equation. But what you're talking about, Rose, are spectrums of voice and thought leadership. Or let's just call them, keep it simple, spectrums of voice. Who gets heard and who narrates the world? And if you look at the spectrum, you know, you can figure this out in a common sense kind of way. Some of those forums are very far along and very hard to access. For example, it's very hard to run for Congress if you have not already made a name for yourself. But some of those forums at the early entry level are very easy to access. And for example, Wikipedia, there's no barrier to entry to contributing an article to Wikipedia, and yet the majority of contributors, 87% actually, are men. Mm. And you know, that's laying the foundation for online encyclopedic knowledge. Or an op-ed. An op-ed has low barrier to entry, very low, in fact, if you look at new media. And it can be often where you might start. If you put an idea out there in the world and it's a powerful idea, then it will get cited and you'll get cited. And you might, for example, a common thing that could happen is after citations, you might get asked to write a follow-up article, or you might be invited to speak somewhere, for example, on your radio show.
Right.
Or you might get a book contract or a fellowship. In fact, there is a kind of trajectory of people who rise in influence, and that is almost always the trajectory. It starts with something simple, an idea out in the world in a concrete place where other people read it and they think, I'd like to hear more about that. And then it snowballs.
And Taryn, final thoughts from you about where this goes from here, 20 seconds?
Well, I have to say, I did an internal survey of our alumni, and one-fifth of them had speaking engagements. I think that the possibilities are enormous, and we think that we're going to hit
a tipping point soon.
Yeah.
All right.
We're
out of time. Taryn Yeager and Katie Ornstein with the Op-Ed Project. Thank you both for joining us.
All right. Thank you
so much for having us.
Thanks. And you can find out about the Saturday seminar at yourcallradio.org. Here's what's coming up tomorrow. How are people around the globe organizing for food justice? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation with Raj Patel, author of Stuffed and Starved, The Hidden Battle for the World Food System. 1 in 7 people on Earth are hungry, and 1 billion people are overweight. Patel says global hunger and obesity are symptoms of the same problem. So how did we get here? Join us at 10 or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Where should we look for solutions? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you.